Hello and welcome to the Waterways Ireland podcast with me, Turtle Bunbury. Today I am joined by Alan Lindley, a man who knows the history of the Grand Canal and the Barrow Navigation extremely well, not least because his family have been on the locks since the canal was constructed in the 1790s. Among those who came to work on the Grand Canal as engineers during the 1790s were the Mitchell brothers from County Antrim. And I'm delighted to be joined by Alan Lindley, who is their descendant eight generations on. Alan, what do we know of your ancestors?
Okay, what we know is that there was two brothers, and they were James and William Mitchell. They went over to work in Scotland originally on the Crianan Canal, and they were known as navvies. They were navigators. Navvies was a shortened term of navigators. They worked on the Crianan Canal for a few years, and they were looking for workers in Ireland on the Grand Canal. And what had happened was they had built the Grand Canal to Tullamore. When it got to Tullamore, it stopped for a couple of years. They ran out of money. When they tried to build a new section from Tullamore to Shannon Harbour, they advertised for workers. But initially, they couldn't get workers because the wages were too low. A bill had to be brought to the House of Commons, and they had to double the wages for the Grand Canal. So that was done. The wages were increased, and the two brothers, James and William Mitchell, decided that the wages were pretty good in Ireland, in Tullamore. So they came to Tullamore to work for a contractor who got the initial contract for building the canal from Tullamore to Shannon Harbour, called Mullins and Henry.
So what do you think they would have been doing in the at that time? I mean, were they physically labouring as navvies, or doing a bit of engineering?
Yeah, no, we know that they we know that James Mitchell was a ganger. Okay, and his role would have been to organise a crew of lads looking at building stone bridges, aqueducts, viaducts, and structures like that. And that's what they seemingly James Mitchell was specialised in. I can't say for definitively what William was specialised in, but we know William worked with him. And both of them worked from Tullamore. You see, when they were building the original canal, just remember, this is going through virgin countryside. And if they cut a swathe in the land, and they basically cut out the side of a hill, took the clay from one side, put it to the other side, and then they came along with blue puddle clay, and they puddled the canal with clay. They put in, it's like a liner, and it sealed the water into the canal. They ran sheep and cattle up and down the canal, and that puddled the clay. And that's how you built in your seal. So that's how they actually built the canal.
Do we have an idea of the numbers of people that would have been involved?
We do. We actually know there was over 2,000 people employed from Tullamore working on the canal. They built the lock houses and the bridges before the canal was actually built. So they used the lock houses then as like an office. So you paid all your wages. So you had all your workers coming down, you paid your wages from the house. The lock was built, and they built the canal towards the locks.
Yeah.
Okay. So the two brothers were working on that. When they built the canal and actually had it up and running, the James and William both applied for the lock positions at the 30th lock in Ran and the 31st lock, which is about half a mile away. And they got the lock keeping positions, which was a nice job to have because you were supplied with a two-story house, you got a weekly pay packet, and you got an acre of land. As the years went by, as the generations went by, the job was passed over from son to son. Okay, so if there was a son that was interested in taking on the position, he took over and he got there was an acre of land and he got a wage packet. But that meant that the family could survive in the lock house, even through the famine. It meant that there was a steady income. Economically, they were stable, you know.
I'm not a big one for, you know, whether working middle, upper class stuff, but where do you think, where would a lock keeper be on that sort of very basic scale, do you think?
They would have been probably, as probably what you would class as a middle class in today's society. Mm. I know that my great grandfather Robert Mitchell actually had, which this seems very odd today, but actually had a servant in the house where he actually worked the lock, and there was a servant in the house working here for him, and his role would have been to look after cattle and sheep and help around the lock. You see, the 30th lock is an unusual lock in the sense that this particular lock had a canal agent's house across the road from the lock, and it also had a lodge about 100 yards down from the lock. So effectively, the lodge would have been used for the changing of horses. You see, the boats, the original barges were drawn by horses. Now, you had two types of barges. You had your M barge, and then you had your fly boats. Now, fly boats are very different to a barge. They were drawn by 7 horses. And the reason why they were called fly boats was because they were high speed.
My goodness, 7 horses must have got a good lick. What sort of speed would they get to? I wonder.
Well, they were able to do the canal in 2 days, where the average barge took 3.5 days, to come from Dublin down.
Okay, so the average barge would have had, they have 7. What would the average barge have had? 3 or 4?
The average barge would have had 1 horse, only 1.
Oh, just the 1. Yeah,
okay. And they'd be pulling maybe 50, 60 ton, of bricks or wheat or Guinness or... But the fly boats actually, they were actually drawing passengers, and those passengers were en route. So you had you came out of Dublin, they came down to Shannon Harbour and they stayed overnight. There's a hotel especially built by the Grand Canal Company in Shannon Harbour, and then you had a steam packet boat down to Shannon, which brought them down to Killaloe, and there was another hotel there.
With the fly boats, those horses, obviously, is it the same 7 horses that are doing the rounds, or do they swap and change them every few?
No, you see, this is where the lodge came in. You have to understand that in the peak of the Grand Canal, we would have had about 100,000 passengers a year. That's 2,000 passengers a week. Now, they would have been all heading to Canada and America. You have to try and imagine now, you had no trains, you had no roads. So this was your passage, okay? You got onto this flyboat in Dublin, and it brought you down to the west of the country. You came down to Shannon and you headed down and into Limerick. And then you got a steam packet then over to Newfoundland or New York. And that's how you got to America.
And you probably never came back again either.
More than likely never came back, yeah. But it's when you look back at it now, 100,000 passengers a year, every year, was travelling on this canal. There would have been 187,000 tonnes of heavy goods, like Guinness and bricks, turf, that would have been transported up and down the canal. So we're talking 40, 50 years before the railways actually took hold.
Okay, so your grandfather, Walter, lockkeeper, was that his full-time role or did he do other things?
And when you were a lockkeeper in those days, you could actually have a little bit of farming on the side. And it was quite common for lockkeepers to have another income. So my grandfather was actually a mechanic before he was a lockkeeper in Birmingham. And so he could actually repair cars and tractors. So he did a bit of that on the side, as well as the lockkeeping position.
He would have been, Walter would have been inspecting cargo.
He would have been, yeah. He would have been checking the cargo. His writing, one thing I always remember about my grandfather was his writing. Beautiful writing. He had these, these leather-bound logbooks. And each barge had to be logged, the day, the time, the crew, the skipper, the cargo, and even the weather. And each one was logged in beautiful fountain pen writing. Is absolutely gorgeous.
And keeping it in the family, tell me about your mother. She was also a lockkeeper.
Okay, my mother took over the role as lockkeeper in 1981 from my grandfather. And she was the lockkeeper from 1981 until 1986. She was working 7 days a week. Your hours, your contracted hours were dawn till dusk, 7 days a week. It was very unusual to see a woman in a position lockkeeping. There was another lady, Mrs. Walsh, back in the 50s who took over. Her husband died young and she was given the position as lockkeeper then. And the reason being was... that she had a young family, but and she had no husband. And in those days, there was no social welfare, there was no death in service, there was no compensation of any type. So the Grand Canal Company took the view that, look, she was a healthy woman, she was well able to do the lock. So she took over the role at Belmont Lock. That would be the 33rd lock, which is a double lock.
Are you saying that Mrs. Walsh and your mum, were they the only two women lock keepers at that time?
Well, there was one more, and that was Patsy Cummins. She took over in the early 80s from her brother, and Martin Cummins. She would have been at Ballycown Lock, the 29th lock.
Alan, your family has a pretty remarkably long connection to the Grand Canal. I think we're back to the 1790s. What can you tell us about them?
Okay, I'll give you just a bit of background. James Mitchell would have been my sixth great-grandfather. He was the first lock keeper here. He actually worked with Mullins and Henry, the building contractors, and took on the position as a lock keeper. He had a son called William, and he took over in the early 1815. And then William had a son called James, and who took over the lock. That went on to another. He handed it down to a guy called William, another son that he had. And William was here for about 6 years and had a wife and got pneumonia and died. And he had three kids, and he married a girl from Kilcormac, which is about 10 miles away. So the Grand Canal Company insisted that she move out, because she at those in those days, that would have been around the 1838, they said no, she couldn't take over. So William's brother would have been Robert Mitchell. He actually did take over. He had a farm in Tullamore in Ballyduff, and he sold the farm and he took over the lock position here. And he subsequently had a son called Robert Mitchell, and he took over in 1890, and he was here until 1931. And that's when Walter Mitchell took over until 1981. And then Louise took over. And then I took over then after my mother in 1986. So I'm 35 years here myself.
My goodness, that's quite a family tree to be on a single canal lock, Alan, and all in the same house. But from that house, I imagine your proximity to the canal would allow you to hear the boats coming.
You see, water carries the sound of an engine. So you could hear that the original boats had a single cylinder Bollinger engine, which kind of made a put, put, put sound. So you'd hear that coming. It'd be like a muffled shotgun sound going, like pump, pump, pump. So you'd hear that coming for 2 miles away, you know. But in those days, in the long ago, like, you know, even in my grandfather's time when there was commercial traffic, it was quite common for the whole family was involved. Like, you have to try and imagine. You have my grandfather doing the lock keeper and agent here. He would have been doing a bit of farming. So some of his sons and daughters would have been helping out around the lock and logging some of the boats while he's doing a bit of farming. Then you would have had my great uncle George. He looked after the horses over in the lodge for the Grand Canal Company. So he took in the horses and fed them and looked after them. And we had Bert then, another great uncle of mine. He actually looked after the leatherwork. He did all the leatherwork for the Grand Canal Company. But all these jobs back in there was a review of the whole Grand Canal system back in 1959. And all these jobs were basically made redundant then. And that's when the commercial traffic more or less ceased a couple of years later. Because they weren't needed. You know, technology had moved on, and most barges in the late 50s had engines, you know.
Were there specific boats for the Grand Canal?
Yeah, there was you had barges called M barges, and you also had E barges. E barges were used by the ESB. The M barges could travel on the Royal and the Grams. However, the Royal barges, they were 70 feet long. The M barges are 60 foot long by 13 foot wide. The M barges were 70 feet long, so they couldn't travel on the Grand Canal, you know. You also had the Barra Navigation. Now, you just have to remember that the Barra Navigation also encompasses the shore, the river shore, the River Blackwater and the River Nore, and goes down into Waterford. So those particular bargemen would have had a lot more knowledge about the rivers, about tidal, and you wouldn't get Grand Canal barragemen really travelling down the Barrow or the Nord, the Shore, the Three Sisters as they're known as, you know, because they wouldn't have had the experience.
Okay, so they'd be a bit nervous. The canal man would be nervous of coming on the on the rivers.
Yeah, yeah.
And was it the same the other way with the river guys?
Guys would pretty much travel the canal. There'd be no issue there. They'd go right down the Shannon as well. So you could have a barge going, let's say, from St. Mullins on the Barrow, coming right up through into Robertstown in Kildare, coming down the Grand Canal into Shannon Harbour, and going right down to Killaloe or Limerick. That wouldn't be unusual, you know. And that'd be a big trip now, you know. So that would definitely take at least a week to do that trip, you know.
Yeah. These days it's called a holiday.
I know, absolutely.
Okay. Is it going to roll on to the next generation, Generation 9?
I don't know. I would like to think so, but it's hard to see with the progression of work, the changes in society, you know, open competitions for jobs. You know, it's there's a lot of obstacles to overcome it for that to happen. But I would like to see it happening, and look, time will tell.
Yeah. Time will tell. So, all right. Yeah. Well, listen, Alan, you've been fabulous. Thank you very much for taking the time to chat. It's been fascinating. So thank you. My sincere thanks again to Alan Lindley for his insights on 8 generations on the canal. And thanks again to you for tuning into the Waterways Ireland podcast. For more insights on the series, go to waterwaysireland.org, or you'll find my own archive of historical stories at turtlebunbury.com. A big thank you to series producer Ali Bunbury, and also to our technical producer Liam Mulvaney of 11 for 10 Productions, who also composed the beautiful music that runs with this series.